Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our creator, not our government. I believe that scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the morning.
Good morning and happy Friday. Today is June 27th, and so much still going on in the Middle East that has really dominated the news this past week. And along with that has been this really dramatic story of a rescue of a lot of American citizens who were in Israel for various reasons during the last weekend and the last few weeks as the Trump administration went into Iran with these bunker buster bombs and all of these headlines. And that has really come mainly from the Free State of Florida and Senator Jay Collins, who's a Green Beret, and also Governor Ron DeSantis, who has sent in these chartered flights and has really done an incredible job just being there, frankly, for American citizens. And one of those stories is actually our good friend Josh Hammer, who is an author and senior editor at large for Newsweek. And he joins me now. And Josh, this actually brought me to tears, frankly, when I read your post online about being in Israel and being one of these that was rescued along with your wife and your little baby. And I'm just so grateful that you and your family are safe. Tell us what happened.
Well, it was quite an ordeal, Jenna. Thank you for that sentiment. It was stressful at times, for sure. So we were there primarily for personal reasons. My wife was raised here in Florida, but she was born in Israel, and a lot of her family is still over there. So we went for my wife's cousin's wedding, had a big surprise birthday party, things like that. And, you know, I tacked on a book event in Jerusalem and various other things as well. But the primary reason that we were over there was for just personal family reasons. And it was on, I guess, our fourth or fifth night that we were there that the sirens went off at 3 a.m. And we learned, kind of groggy, you know, you kind of rub your eyes, go on Twitter, what the heck is happening? And then that's when you learn that the IDF operations inside Iran had begun. And that was the beginning of what is now being referred to as the 12-day war, I suppose. So for the first few days, we tried to ride out the storm. And the first ballistic missiles from the Iranians came right on Friday evening local time in Israel. This was a couple Fridays ago, so that's the Jewish Sabbath, of course. I literally had my Sabbath prayers interrupted to run to the bomb shelter that first time with my wife and our little six-month-old daughter. And that was kind of the way it went for a few days. We were just constantly on pins and needles waiting for the phone to buzz or the sirens in the city to go off, and then you know it's time to run to the bomb shelter. And it was a very nocturnal war for the first few days. It was oftentimes these 2, 3, 4, 5 a.m. rushes to the bomb shelter. And when the sirens go off, Jenna, something to understand here is you only have 90 seconds to 2 minutes. There's really not a ton of time, especially given just the sheer speed at which these hypersonic ballistic missiles are coming. And that's another part of the story here that is relevant, is that a lot of the Israeli apartment buildings and homes, thank goodness, have safe rooms, which are extra fortified. If you knock on the wall of one of these safe rooms, you will tell the difference between that and a standard room. It's extra super fortified concrete, depending on how modern the structure or edifice is. But these safe rooms were typically constructed with lower-level Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad rockets or mortars from Gaza in mind. They were not necessarily constructed with hypersonic ballistic missiles coming from the atmosphere from the largest state sponsor of jihad in the world, 2,000 miles away. So I say all that because, tragically, the air defense in Israel was doing a very good job, but not an amazing job. There were too many missiles that were slipping through. Real damage was being caused, and people were dying. And the final wake-up call for me was the third or fourth night after the war started, was there was a neighboring town to where we were staying, where the Israeli media started reporting that there were two people tragically who died while they were in their bomb shelter. So they did everything they were supposed to do, and because it was a direct hit from one of these missiles, it did not protect them. So that's when I said, my goodness, I need to get the heck out of here. So I started doing research, and I found my way to the man that you mentioned a couple minutes ago, Senator Jay Collins of the great state of Florida, and an amazing man, former Army Green Beret, who was the state of Florida's representative there on the ground in Israel on behalf of a Governor DeSantis Florida adjacent program in partnership with a rescue organization called Gray Bull Rescue. And they exist to help get Americans out of conflict zones. And Jenna, look, it's not necessarily my instinct when the Jewish state is under siege to leave the Jewish state. I just wrote a book, Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation, The Destiny of the West, a few months ago. I'm a religious Jew, a proud Zionist. It's not my instinct to flee the Jewish state when it is under siege by a hegemonic foe. But you have to understand that in a situation like this, I'm thinking first and foremost as a father, as a father to a beautiful six-month-old baby girl. So I got in touch with Gray Bull Rescue and Senator Jay Collins, and thus began the very long and arduous journey home. It took us about 3.5 days in total to get from point A to point B. It was not without drama. On our way to the evacuation point to get to the bus, we actually drove right by a factory that had been hit minutes earlier by an Iranian ballistic missile. It was smoking fire, billowing black smoke for as far as the eye can see. Pretty harrowing stuff, images that I'm not going to forget anytime soon. We got on the bus. The bus took us to the Jordanian border, which was absolute chaos. A lot of people trying to flee, as you can imagine. Got past the border, got to Amman, the capital of Jordan, did a night in Amman, Jordan, then flew to Cyprus. Cyprus is actually a close ally of Israel. It became something of a hub for a lot of Israelis either fleeing or in some cases actually trying to go back home to fight for their country. So we got to Cyprus, spent an unexpected night in Cyprus, and then took one of these DeSantis Florida charter planes, actually the first of the charter planes, straight from Cyprus to Tampa, Florida. And there was no Wi-Fi on the flight, Jenna, so I was a little surprised when I landed and opened up my phone, and it turned out that Ron DeSantis was actually right there at Tampa International Airport to greet us last Friday morning at 5:30 a.m. And then doubly to my surprise, because I know the governor a little bit, I'm a Floridian like you are, when I saw him, he actually invited me to join him at his impromptu press conference there. So I was sleep-deprived, got this 13-hour flight, hadn't had a good night's sleep, as you can imagine, in a week at least. And I did my best at the press conference, Jenna, and then we finally ended up taking like a little mini bus van type thing back home to South Florida, which is what we call home. But it was quite an ordeal, to put it mildly, but I'm just super grateful for the leadership of the state of Florida. And it was certainly a tale that I will recount, I presume, in my next book whenever it comes time for that.
Wow. What an incredible story, Josh Hammer. And again, I'm so grateful that you and your family are safe. And this is something that, you know, no one should ever have to go through. But I'm also thankful that there are leaders like Governor DeSantis, Senator Collins, and even, you know, the Trump administration. And hopefully with this outlook on and this action in Iran, preventing further harm to America and the world, and certainly Israel further down the line. So let's talk first about with this whole experience. You obviously, as a prolific commentator in political news and events, and your connection with Israel as well, I'm sure have very strong opinions on this intervention in Iran. And so what has been your overall perspectives as you've seen kind of the divide among the conservative or the MAGA base with this kind of, we'll characterize it as Tucker versus Ted Cruz, I think, divide. What's your view overall on what those arguments are and where the strategy should be?
So first of all, Jenna, let me say that a lot of people talk about this divide within MAGA. I think that this divide is frankly a little overstated. There are some very loud voices. You name Tucker Carlson. There are others as well. He's probably the most prominent one who have been, you know, shrieking hysterical against anything remotely resembling U.S. touching the Middle East. You know, Tucker had this post on social media back in March predicting that there would be thousands of American casualties if America were to striker on. He obviously looks tremendously silly right now. Not that we can expect an apology to come to his audience for duping and misleading them. But I think this is all a little overstated just based on the polling that I've seen. I saw a poll a couple days ago from CBS News, about as reputable mainstream pollster as you're going to get. Overall, Republicans support Donald Trump's strike in Iran by roughly a 76-18 ratio. And self-identified MAGA Republicans, it's even greater. It's 94-6. Literally 94% of self-identified, according to CBS News poll, MAGA Republicans support Donald Trump's operation in Iran. So I have no idea why there are some very loud, prominent voices out there that are rushing to try to gobble up that 6% market share. It frankly makes no sense to me, to be honest with you. So I'm not entirely sure how real the divide is among actual MAGA Republicans. There is a divide, I will concede, among kind of the MAGA commentariat, the MAGA pundits and talking heads there. From my perspective, Jenna, there's a lot of people overthinking this. It's actually really quite simple. For as long as I have been alive, definitely in my entire adult lifetime, the Iranian nuclear program has been a subject of intense debate. It has been a broader sword of Damocles hanging over not just the Middle East, but in many ways, Western civilization, and certainly the United States, given the fact that this regime, their entire purpose of this fanatical Islamist regime, their raison d'etre, is to eliminate, to kill what they refer to as the little Satan of Israel and the big Satan of the United States. That is literally why they exist. They've in kleptocratic fashion, they've swindled trillions of dollars from their own people and directed them towards various proxies and terrorists throughout the region, all trying to accomplish this one genocidal aim of destroying the little Satan of Israel and the big Satan of America. So given that this is an issue that has confounded our foreign policy discourse for 2.5-3 decades now, the fact that Donald Trump went in, and to be clear, he went in not purely on his own, but building off of the tremendous operational tactical brilliance, frankly, of the Israel Defense Forces and Mossad, but coming there on the back end with the B-2 bombers and the bunker buster bombs to maybe not literally obliterate the nuclear program, but at a bare minimum set it back by many, many years. That seems to be the Israelis' assessment based on what we know thus far. If you were to tell me beforehand that this could be accomplished, not only without a single American casualty, but without a single shot fired from within Iran at any of the B-2 bombers, are you kidding me? I mean, what an incredible bang-for-your-buck proposition. And this is classic Donald Trump foreign policy. He's not an isolationist. He's obviously not a neoconservative either, but he is not an isolationist. He is a third-way nationalist realist. Jacksonian is a term that oftentimes gets batted around to describe Donald Trump's foreign policy. This is entirely consistent with Donald Trump's first-term foreign policy approach as well, when he took out Qasem Soleimani, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Quds Force commander at the airport in Baghdad, Iraq, in January 2020, when he took out al-Baghdadi, the former head of ISIS in Syria in 2017, around then as well. This is entirely consistent with that. So it's consistent. It's the right thing to do. I think President Trump, frankly, looks fantastic from having pulled it off as successfully as he did.
Yeah, and I think you know, you're right in that sense that, you know, the media, of course, and online discourse tends to amplify a lot of the divides wherever they can. I do think that there is room in the conversation, though, to recognize that there are a lot of differences between kind of the Tucker and maybe Candace Owens wing versus the Ted Cruz, and where I would put myself maybe a little bit more in a little bit different theological interpretation than what Ted Cruz articulated on Tucker's interview. But overall, to say that, you know, there are some differences, but to the extent that we are all still America first and do support Israel in the ways that that historically America has, yeah, some of that is definitely overblown. And so where should our foreign policy go from here when you have someone like Trump, who our mutual good friend Steve Dace said yesterday on the program that, you know, Trump is very much a pragmatist. He's not exactly consistently principled, at least in a more ideological framework. And so if we're looking at solid foreign policy that maybe blends a good balance of both, where do we go from here?
I think Donald Trump's foreign policy is very consistent, which is that he understands that America has scarce resources to use and to deploy on the geopolitical stage. And I think he properly intuits, understands that America's number one rival in the 21st century is China. That's actually another interesting element of this, by the way, Jenna. A lot of folks, again, from that Tucker wing, we might call it, are saying, oh, this is a monumental distraction. We should be putting more of our assets in China, not getting bogged down in the Middle East. I see this, unsurprisingly, quite differently, actually. I, too, share the goal of America in the mid to long term, maybe even short to midterm, really trying to redeploy as many assets as possible to focus on what is our number one by far threat, the Chinese Communist Party. But the thing is, if you want to accomplish that, among other things that you're going to have to do is try to have the Middle East be as stable as it can possibly be. It's probably never going to be the most stable region of the world, but as stable as it can possibly be. Well, how did you accomplish that? By crushing Iran and its nuclear program and its proxy terror organizations throughout the region there. And right now, Iran, with its nuclear program pretty much entirely defanged, with its various proxies, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Palestine, Islamic Jihad in Gaza, the Houthis in Yemen, Kataib, Hezbollah in Iraq, all the various Iranian proxies in the region that have caused so much carnage and bloodshed for decades, they are grievously wounded right now from the United States and really more than anything from Israel, what Israel has done since October 7th. So the Middle East is actually probably the most stable and secure at this exact moment after Operation Midnight Hammer than the region has been in my entire lifetime, which is a very, very good thing. And that should actually make it easier. That should pave the way to then have this military, diplomatic, and so forth asset redeployment towards the Indo-Pacific there. So that's kind of how I see it. I know a lot of folks in the administration at both state and the Pentagon are kind of China firsters. I don't shy away from that label either. Again, I also think that China is by far America's number one threat. But for various reasons, Jenna, America is always going to have some reasons to care about the Middle East. We're going to care about the Middle East for at least three basic reasons. Quickly, I'll name them. One is we care about oil and natural gas. That should be obvious. There's really no way getting around that. Two is we care about freedom of navigation on some of the world's most important waterways, especially the Red Sea, the Suez Canal, things like that, when it comes to having prices be reduced on the home front. The third is for the reason that you very eloquently speak about time and time again, which is that for as long as America remains a majority or at least a plurality Christian country there, and especially a more religious country than most other Western nations, and praise be to God for that, there are going to be special idiosyncratic reasons for Americans to care about the fate of the Holy Land in particular. So we're going to have interest in the Middle East. The question then is, how do you have a stable Middle East that will then allow America to focus on its number one threat, China? I think the president has taken a tremendous step, actually, in really crushing the Iranian nuclear program towards accomplishing that very necessary objective.
Yeah, well said. And in just the last minute or so I have with you, Josh Hammer, you know, your book that's out is so timely. Tell people about that quickly and where they can get that. We have, you know, about a minute and a half or so left.
Sure. So the book, Jenna, is called Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. I did get kind of lucky with the timing, to be honest with you. It came out in March, but it has been very timely for all of these months. The book, as you and I have discussed previously, is not just about contemporary foreign policy debates, although all of that is very much in there. There's actually an entire chapter making the America First Trump doctrine nationalist realist case for U.S.-Israel relations. That chapter, Chapter 7, is probably literally timelier than ever at this exact moment. But there are lots of other chapters in the book that talk about the West biblical inheritance, the joint obligation of Jews and Christians as the world's two biblical religions to continue this amazing inheritance that we have onto our children and our children's children and so forth there. So there's a lot of good stuff in there. It's really intended, Jen, I'd say, above all for a Christian audience. I think this audience will really appreciate it. It's called Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West, available everywhere books are sold.
Thanks so much. We'll be right back with more. This June 24th marks 3 years since Roe v. Wade was overturned. But here's what you may not know. Abortion numbers have surged to a 10-year high. The battleground has shifted from the courtroom to our homes. Today, over 60% of abortions happen through the abortion pill, taken in silence and often alone. Preborn Network clinics are standing in the gap, meeting women in their most desperate hour. And here's what they're seeing. Young mothers, terrified and misled, are delivering their babies, tiny, perfectly formed, onto bathroom floors. These precious babies, once called just tissue, now are lifeless. 11% of these women who take the abortion pill will suffer serious health complications. Countless others carry emotional scars for a lifetime. When you give to Preborn, you're not just saving a baby, you're saving a mother as well. You're giving her hope, financial support, and the truth. Preborn has already rescued over 350,000 babies, but there are so many more who need our help. Your tax-deductible gift makes this mission possible. To donate now, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, let's turn back to D.C. and the One Big Beautiful Bill that is still controversial, I think, somewhat in terms of some of the more stalwart Republicans like the Thomas Massies, the Chip Roys of the House. And then you have Speaker Mike Johnson and others who are saying that this is, you know, wonderful legislation. We've got to pass this. But meanwhile, it's being marked up in the Senate. And Chip Roy posted yesterday, I think, a really helpful chart on his X feed that says the House OBBB versus the Senate's version of the One Big Beautiful Bill, and says this: it is not where it needed to be in the House, but it's markedly worse in the Senate. We're not here to increase deficits, keep the Green New Scam subsidies, give tax breaks to high tax blue states, fund transgender surgeries, refuse to expand health savings accounts, etc. So for all this and more, let's bring in our good friend Mark Lauder, who is former Everything Trump campaign and now a Newsmax host on Wake Up America, where you can watch him there, and always fun to see that. So, Mark, great to speak with you again. And, you know, your thoughts overall on the One Big Beautiful Bill, and also kind of the controversy here, because I think people who are very dedicated to saying this is the best legislation ever, you know, kind of say that the Massies and the Chip Roys are too much perfectionists. But then they say, you know, hey, there are some real concerns here. So where do you land?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a challenge, and I've never, ever in my entire career ever seen a perfect piece of legislation. And we're in the middle of the sausage-making process, you know, that they say that there's two things you don't want to see made: laws and sausage. And that's what we are in right now. And the challenge is, between the House and the Senate, we have to remember House members have much smaller districts, much more compact, usually very similar, whether they're urban, suburban, rural, a little bit of a couple things here and there. Senators have all of those things in all of their districts because they represent states. And so they approach these things much differently than, say, a suburban congressman would. So there's going to be a back and forth. I highly doubt, and this is just me, that whatever the Senate comes up with and gets 50 Senate, that's all it needs in the Senate is 50. The House is going to have its issues. They probably will not vote on it. They'll have to then go to a conference committee and try to come up with some happy middle before it gets to the president's desk.
Yeah, and what that happy middle looks like, I think, is the real question. And so with some of this in the Senate, where do you think this goes if it passes the Senate, which I think that it will, and then ultimately goes back over to the House?
Well, and I mean, the problem we face is, you know, and I think it's beyond just this bill in particular. It's also a problem that the Republican Party faces overall, is it's a growing party. It's becoming a much more diverse party. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, the majority is not being made right now in Kentucky, or really even in Tennessee. or Texas. It's actually being made in New York and in California, where we are flipping what used to be blue seats into red seats, and they have different priorities. In order to win and be reelected, they have to represent their constituencies. And so some of this is a little bit of what I would call growing pains of a party that's newly diverse, has new members who would like to continue to be members, and making sure that their voters are represented. It's easy to rail against blue states, but we have a growing number of people who are coming from blue states. We're making blue states redder. And so we have to remember that as we kind of go through all of these pieces, it's not just the ruby red MAGA districts, because there's just not enough of them to pass a legislation or to win a majority.
And in terms of the potential political capital that Trump is expending on the One Big Beautiful Bill, I mean, I think that he's gained a lot of support with all of this going on in Iran, with, you know, what came out yesterday with his statement supporting Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, you know, against this kind of ridiculous corruption trial, you know, and so many other things, border security, you know, the economy. I mean, gas prices are now lower, and when people aren't talking about that and you don't have Democrats tweeting about the price of eggs, then that tells you that, you know, that wasn't a great talking point for them. But in terms of the political capital, and especially because the longer we get into this year, the focus is going to be more and more increasingly on the midterms. Do you think that this legislation is costing him any political capital? I mean, I kind of see it as like a net neutral.
Well, I think it will be a net positive once they get something passed. I was there in 2017, 2018, when the first round, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the Trump tax cuts, were passed. And by the way, it was ugly getting there. We had the same arguments, the same fights. You had the true fiscal conservatives that wanted to cut more. You had those who were trying to balance raising, you know, cutting taxes and how much can you cut spending and where are you cutting it from? No different than it was then, but once it was done, it was hugely popular. So I do believe once they hit it there, they will see the net benefit of it. It's just getting through this process of taking an idea or taking a bunch of campaign promises and actually putting them in legislation that could pass.
And I hope that once we get past this One Big Beautiful Bill, then Congress can actually focus on some other priorities that we, you know, genuinely really haven't seen from them. And I'm speaking with Mark Lauder, who's former Trump campaign, Trump administration, now a Newsmax host on Wake Up America. And personal friend of mine for a long time. And so, you know, we've been through the trenches with everything Trump. And so, you know, when we look at where Congress really does need to codify a lot of these policy priorities that Trump has emphasized, in my view, you know, this really hasn't been a whole lot better than the trifecta of the early Paul Ryan days in the beginning of Trump's first administration, with the exception that obviously Speaker Johnson is in lockstep with the president. He's not an antagonist and an opponent like Paul Ryan was as the former speaker. But if Congress can't actually get it together to codify some of these things, then is that really any better?
Well, I think part of it is it's the nature of the job. I mean, you literally have 435 independent contractors who are out really not for anything other than their own best interest. And that could be political best interest. And it's like herding cats. And it doesn't really matter whether it's a Speaker Paul Ryan, a Speaker Kevin McCarthy, a Speaker Mike Johnson. They may have different styles. They may have differing takes on the president. And obviously, clearly they did. But ultimately, they're trying to get to 217, 218 votes to pass a piece of legislation, and where do those votes come from? And the challenge we face is when you get one specific caucus or group of lawmakers who are holding out, that means you've got to go get votes from Democrats. And whenever you get a vote from a Democrat, it comes usually with a B on the end of it, meaning another $1 billion in spending on whatever pet giveaway project they want. And so, you know, the problem, I think, long-term and I think Speaker Johnson's done a great job of this, is that we've got to get to a point where lawmakers, conservatives, can say 90% of what I want is good enough for now. I will fight for the 10%. I will campaign on it. I will never end my championing of it. But don't let the 90% fall on the vine while I wait for 100% of what I want.
Yeah, and we've had many years of conversations about that, Mark Lauder, where, you know, it's never going to be 100% of, you know, what you want, because the 100% obviously looks different to even among Republicans or conservatives. And I think that that's an important point, that we're never going to have 100% of everybody, even within the wider GOP or even a smaller segment of the GOP, happy all the time with things. And so, you know, what about the judiciary and how this all factors into the mix? Because there have been a few important, I think, opinions from the Supreme Court, even just in the last few days, where the Supreme Court overturned that temporary hold on Trump's enforcement of his immigration policy. That was a good thing. And we've seen a few other instances of the Supreme Court kind of stepping in and saying no to these kind of overreaching federal judges. But that also seems to be still a sticking point. But then Trump has been nominating a lot of, I think, some really good people to the federal bench. Even, you know, this week there was a clip of a Trump nominee who just, you know, went off on some of these woke radical judges. And I thought, these are the types of people that we need on the federal bench.
Oh, absolutely. You know, but it's, you know, the one thing, and it's been one of, it vexes all presidents, regardless of party, is, you know, you nominate them based on their record when they're looking for that job, when they're looking for that promotion to another court or to a higher court. And as soon as they get there and they have a job for life, then suddenly the shackles come off of them and what they truly believe comes out. And we've seen the instances where we've had justices primarily who've been promoted or nominated by conservative presidents who've turned out to be liberal. And gone with the liberal side. You don't usually see it the other way around, but we do have some of that instances. So it's always going to be a challenge. I do think that eventually the Supreme Court is going to have to get involved with the judicial overreach of district judges making nationwide law. They are not one-man presidents or women presidents. And I do think you've seen it over and over again, primarily from Justices Thomas and Alito, to wanting to rein that in. They fear Congress might do it. And the question is going to be, is the Supreme Court going to self-police? Are they going to have to see until Congress gets involved? But really, for the good of the country, the presidency, not just any one president, we have to make sure that we keep these judges in line and within their constraints, because You cannot hamstring and have hundreds of presidents running around out there in robes of either party. We have to have a president that's elected by the people and accountable to them.
Yes, 100%. And I think that has been a frustration that we've seen throughout Trump's first administration, now into the second. And, you know, we've consistently seen this, you know, well before that and past. And so, you know, with this, as we do head into the midterms, what is your take overall on the landscape and how we're seeing, you know, Trump won by a landslide in 2024, but then we see things like this week, the Democrat primary on this ridiculous, just so far left Muslim communist, basically, that won the primary for the New York mayor. And so I don't think that the Democrats are just in disarray and their ideology is going away anytime soon. So where, in your view and your expertise with some of these critical races, where should conservatives in the GOP be paying the most attention to keep a trifecta moving forward?
Well, I think the first thing that we have to remember is that success breeds success. And the midterms, regardless of president, regardless of party, are always a referendum on where things are in the country right now. So that right there means this is why you should extend the Trump tax cuts through the One Big Beautiful Bill, double down and continue to fund border operations, immigration enforcement, deregulate, things like that. Because when people feel better about the direction of the country, they see the president delivering on his promises. If the economy is still going great, if gas is still cheap, grocery prices are coming down, Republicans will win up and down the ballot and in places where the Democrats, you know, are going to fail. I mean, every Democrat in New York, New Jersey should have to answer for this radical socialist, nearly communist mayor nominee that they're putting forward. Even if he ends up not winning, they need to be made to own everything he says, like he would have NYPD arrest Benjamin Netanyahu. Those kinds of things have to be, we have to hold their feet to the fire, because while I would have anticipated that the Democrat Party would move back to the middle, and you have people out there like Rahm Emanuel, who is a brilliant political strategist, by the way, do not underestimate him. He wants to move the party back to Bill Clinton. But you've got Bernie, you got AOC out there moving it further to the left. That's where the energy of their party is. And so when Chuck Schumer is forced to endorse this mayor nominee, we need to make sure that people know that's the Democrat right now. The Democrat Party believes in defunding the police, government-run grocery stores, no immigration enforcement, free food, free everything for everyone. I mean, that's where they are.
Yeah, and I think that is becoming even more and more apparent, and the ideologues certainly need to keep pushing that message. But in just about the last 30 seconds we have with you, Mark Lauder, how important is the consistency of, you know, the principled ideology versus just, you know, what you're describing, where people just vote based on, you know, the price of groceries, the price of gas, and how it really hits home for them? Where should the GOP be focusing more of their messaging?
Well, I would say that we need to focus our messaging on continuing to grow the party. And we need to make all voters, whether they're a traditional, longtime, or new voters, invest in the policy, because as many times before, Jenna, Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980-84, Bush begrudgingly in 1988. Reagan Democrats went back to being Democrats. Donald Trump's name will not be on the ballot in 2028. We need you to be supportive of the America First agenda that he supports, he endorses, he developed, but not just about his name. So that way the next generation can continue his fight once he's not on the ballot.
Well said, Mark Lauder. You can follow him at Mark_Lauder on X, and we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
The month of June has been hijacked by the anti-Christian culture to show their pride in something God calls an abomination. When you support AFR, you help us continue to stand for godly values and provide the resources for you to stay in the know about the enemy's tactics. To say thank you for your gift this month, we'll give you the booklet, Inside the LGBTQ Push of the 1990s, to help strengthen your convictions. Just go to afr.net/offers. afr.net/offers.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as we are headed into next week, where we will be celebrating July 4th, Independence Day, and everything that it means to be an American, looking at the founding of our country, the beautiful Declaration of Independence, and then our U.S. Constitution, of course, which was ratified years later. It's a good thing as we move forward to kind of look back at where we've come from and why we are a nation that is built on the Judeo-Christian worldview, why we have had God as the center and the of our principles and our American heritage. And there is a brand new book out called Star Spangled Blessings, Devotions for Patriots. It is co-authored by our good friend Todd Starnes, who of course hosts his own radio show and has toddstarnes.com. So for more on this and to be a little more patriotic and American in our last segment for our Friday, let's welcome in Todd Starnes to talk about Star Spangled Blessings. Good morning, Todd.
Jenna, always great hanging out with you. Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. And, you know, I love this book and even just the cover of this. It evokes this kind of nostalgia that I think we really need to preserve in today's society to really understand our American heritage. So tell us about Star Spangled Blessings.
Jenna, I am so excited for our AFR audience to read this little book, and it was a fun book to write. My dear friend Michelle Cox, she and I met many years ago at a Christian writers conference at Ridgecrest, and this is our second devotion book that we write together. And I made a joke with my publisher because, you know, I write a lot of political books, Jenna, and I said, you got to give me a chance to write something that doesn't get me death threats. So This is the result of that. But it's a fun book that explores how God has blessed America through very different ways. And so we wanted to craft a devotion book that the entire family could enjoy together. Or if you don't have kids or grandkids, you're still going to love this book. But my co-author, Michelle, she has, I think, 7 or 8 grandkids. And she wanted to make sure that her grandchildren were learning these stories about how God used people in so many unusual ways to bless our country.
Mm. And, you know, I think that heritage and seeing God's movements throughout history, which is how a professor of mine, you know, way back in undergrad, in journalism, described looking at history, recording news of the day, you know, is recording God's movements throughout history. Looking back at the clear intervention of the Lord at critical moments in America is so important, I think, because then we can genuinely expect for the Lord to continue to intervene for his people and hopefully for our nation as well, if he continues to choose to bless us. And so, you know, what are some of the stories and the focal points that you highlight?
Well, we take people through American history pretty quickly, and from George Washington to Donald Trump, and we tell these stories. Many of them people have never even heard. For example, a lot of folks may not be aware that Dwight D. Eisenhower was actually our most religious president, devout president. Thanks to Eisenhower, faith was introduced into the public marketplace. You know, back in the 1950s, we were in the throes of the Cold War. There was a battle between communism and capitalism. And Eisenhower knew right away that this was not a political fight. This was a spiritual fight. And that's how Eisenhower framed it. That's how Ronald Reagan framed it as well. And the founder of the modern conservative movement, William F. Buckley Jr., of course, their involvement came a few years later. But Eisenhower, Jenna, was the very first president, the only president, who has been baptized after he was inaugurated. About a week or so after Inauguration Day, Eisenhower, we don't know, it was a private ceremony, so we don't know if he took the Baptist plunge or the Presbyterian sprinkle, but he got baptized in Washington, D.C.
Mm, that's incredible. And, you know, all of these stories that aren't just sort of the mainline vignettes that you hear from News of the Day, I think are really important, Todd Starnes, for especially young people to read as well. And I know that there's, you know, a large segment here of our audience who are younger, or if you're a grandparent or parent and you have young person, get this book to have them read this, because, you know, seeing some of these stories, I think, is important for grounding in our own faith, but also, you know, seeing the tradition of religion in America is such a contrast from what we're seeing with the left trying to take over America, really a hostile takeover for this kind of communist, even, you know, Muslim, if we're looking at the New York Democratic primary election. And it's important to contrast the truth of the biblical worldview to anything else that is false, and see that through America's history.
You know, Jenna, you're so right about that. And so we have some fun components. Not only do we have a daily devotional
We call them Yankee Doodles, which are fun questions that can spark conversations around the breakfast table or, you know, maybe after dinner. Then we have a Liberty lesson. Every devotion comes with a Liberty lesson. And we also provide a Patriot prayer. So we're praying for specific things about the country. But I want people to know it's not a political book. This is a book for Christian patriots, patriots who love God. And we also include recipes. And Jenna, the recipes are worth the price of the book. We had some of our listeners send in their favorite summertime recipes. My favorite would be the sweet potato biscuits and honey glazed ham. It's pretty righteous. But these are unhealthy recipes, but they're delicious recipes.
That's the American tradition, though, right, Todd Starnes? I don't think that we can truly celebrate America's independence without getting, you know, a little Southern fried comfort, right?
That's it. And by the way, one of my favorite stories in the book, there are two, and I've got to tell you about our book cover, our artwork, because it's funny how that came about. By the way, Ronald Reagan was a soul winner, and we tell a story, and I will say this, I actually read that chapter every time we do a book signing, and we were in Tupelo a couple of weeks ago speaking to a group of Republicans, and everywhere we read this story, it's the very last devotion of the book, people are weeping in the crowd. It is just such a beautiful, poignant story of how Ronald Reagan loved to tell people about Jesus. And it's really a great way to kind of wrap up the book. But the cover, if you've seen the cover art, I knew I wanted a front porch. I knew I wanted rocking chairs. I just couldn't get the view right. And I was trying to explain it to the designers and the publishing company, you know, what we were looking for. One day, Jenna, I'm literally shopping at the Piggly Wiggly. I'm at the condiment section, the condiment aisle, and I look over, and there it was. The ranch hidden, it was the Hidden Valley Ranch salad dressing bottle. And that view is actually what you see on the cover of our book.
That's amazing. And, you know, you can almost smell the Southern fried cooking and the ranch dressing looking at this, at the cover of this book. I mean, it really is very nostalgic and kind of the front porch. And, you know, for those who know that, you know, I still love the nostalgia of Disney World and, you know, Walt Disney's love of patriotism and all of that. I mean, this reminds me kind of the front porch a little bit of the theater in Magic Kingdom, where you can actually visit the Hall of the Presidents, and, you know, kind of there's still a lot of patriotism there, along with some controversies and all of that. But, you know, this type of like the bunting and the heritage and all of that is just really wonderful on this book. So where can people get this, and can they get it in time to have some of these recipes for July 4th?
Oh, absolutely. You can go down to your local bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, all of the big box stores, Books a Million, they all carry the book. Or you can go to Amazon, where they have a Kindle version. And if you're an Amazon Prime member, we are offering the audio version, which I recorded. That's free of charge. So you can, it's a pretty good deal. So you can really get it wherever you buy your books, or you can order it online wherever you buy your books.
That's amazing. Well, the book is Star Spangled Blessings by our good friend Todd Starnes. And the tagline there is devotions for patriots, but it includes all of these great recipes. And Todd, before I let you go at the end of this segment, you know, overall, we're with the nostalgia that we've talked about, with the love of America, patriotism, all of this, where do you see America headed overall with you know, everything that's going on in the world? I know, you know, our hope is found in Christ. And, you know, maybe just give listeners on this Friday, you know, last segment, just maybe some hope for the future. Or where do you see America going if we are still grounded in truth?
Jenna, I really am encouraged by the direction of our nation, and we are seeing the young people of America embrace the faith of our grandparents and our great grandparents, and the values of our you know, parents and great grandparents, and I think that's very encouraging. Look, yeah, we're going through some difficult times, rocky road, no doubt about it, and a lot of people are getting nervous. But again, I think we have to remember that our hope has to be based on our faith in Christ and not who is in the White House. And that, it's not about politics. This is about focusing our eyes on Christ and following the teachings of the Bible. And I think that's one of the reasons why American Family Radio is so vitally important, because every single day We talk about the big issues of the day on AFR, but we also set things in perspective and remind people that ultimately God is in control.
Amen to that. Well, Todd Stearns, thanks so much for your perspective and always calling us back to the truth and the things of Christ, because that really is where our hope ultimately lies. It's not in a country, a sovereign nation, or even a king. It's always in the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. So the book is Star Spangled Blessings, Devotions for Patriots. You can get that anywhere that books are sold, including online, by our good friend Todd Stearns. Follow him on X at Todd Stearns. Have a great weekend, and we will see you Monday for Independence Day week. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.